This podcast is part of the Gonna Geek Network. The opinion expressed may not represent other podcasts or affiliates of Gonna Geek. Check out more podcasts at GonnaGeek.com and get ready because geekiness starts in 3, 2, 1.
Critics say we should be watching these movies.
But we're here to see if they're right.
Join us as we take a cinematic journey through independent and classic film.
So dim the lights.
And get ready for the show.
This is Art House Legends Podcast, where high art and geek culture collide. Now remember, lads, on this podcast, we drive on the wrong side of the road. This is the movie dude Eric, and along with me are...
Hi, this is Kent, and hang on, lads, I got a great idea.
Hey, this is Chris, and you wouldn't hit a man with no trousers on, would you?
Absolutely. In this episode, we're discussing The Italian Job, starring Michael Caine, Noel Coward, Benny Hill, Ralph Vallone, Margaret Bly, and directed by Peter Collinson. Now, you might be thinking to yourself, but I don't remember that Italian Job. I remember one with Marky Mark and Mos Def, and directed by the guy who did Straight Outta Compton. Well, you know, that was a remake of a 1969 movie, which, if I were to explain that movie to you, would sound a lot more like the remake of Ocean's 11, which is making my eyes cross, thinking about how, yeah. But out of curiosity, though, how familiar were you with this version of The Italian Job, or were you even aware of the remake?
I think I saw when the remake came out, all I was thinking was, isn't that a remake of a better movie from the 60s? Even though I hadn't seen either one, it just looked immediately like, nah.
Well, what about you, Chris? Were you familiar with this version of The Italian Job?
I knew it existed, but I'd never seen it. And actually, like, I haven't seen it lately, so it may be awful now, but I remember seeing the remake of The Italian Job and actually kind of enjoying it. So, yeah.
Well, I went and saw The Italian Job, the remake, in theaters when it initially came out, and I've enjoyed that movie a lot. I own that movie, and I will admit it was silly, and it was completely 100%, you know, studio-driven summer fare. But I was also a big fan of director F. Gary Gray because I love Set It Off, and I loved The Negotiator. And so I was really excited about seeing The Italian Job, considering that I didn't even know that that was a remake. It was only after I saw that film that I was told that there was an earlier film. And I'll be honest here, I didn't see the original because I didn't want it affecting how much I really enjoyed the remake. You know, that's kind of the same reason why I didn't watch the original Ocean's 11, which I had given that people who I trust have told me that, you can completely ignore that original Ocean's 11. It was a piece of crap. So I take their word on that, and I still haven't seen it. I know, maybe future podcast. I doubt it, though. But I will say, though, that when we decided that we were going to do The Italian Job, the original, it came about, it was kind of a weird way that we got to this choice, but at the same time, though, it's just like, yeah, we got to do some Michael Caine. You know, I don't think we've even talked about Michael Caine before, in any of our episodes. And I feel like if we got to do it now, right?
How did we avoid Michael Caine for that long?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I just don't know. But now we're here. Now we have The Italian Job. And this is really one of his first leading star movies. Now, before this, you know, he was a character actor. He had done a lot of stuff, I believe, on television. And he had done bit parts in, you know, big movies. But this was the first time that he was the headliner. He was the big name. He was the big draw. Along with Noel Coward, of all things, in a posh mod 60s hip movie. Wow, this is, I will say, I can't imagine how difficult it was to sell this movie to audiences. I mean, not just to, you know, outside of Britain, how could you have sold this movie to an international market? And of course, the best answer for that is it didn't. It completely bombed outside of Britain for that exact reason and other things, which we will get into as we talk about this movie. But what were you familiar with regarding the cast of this movie going into it? Who were you aware of? What names kind of drew to you? And I think I'm going to start with you, Kent, because I think you probably had a lot more knowledge about this.
My brain stops at Benny Hill because I was raised on Benny Hill. I mean, I don't know if they ever syndicated the Benny Hill show when you were younger, when they really kind of stopped that, but that was, oh god, you're up late at night on a weekend, and by late I mean like 11 o'clock midnight, and on the semi-independent channels, there's the Benny Hill show. Or on PBS,
it's
there's the Benny
PBS.
Hill show. It's called PBS. Yeah, so, well, for some reason, one of our independent stations carried for a while too, but it's like, that, it was there. It's like, you know who Benny Hill is, and I was kind of shocked looking and going, I always thought Benny Hill was more of a mid-70s show. It's mid-60s. So he's in this movie basically kind of midway or...
Oh, no. You know that they were using him as a draw.
Oh, yeah.
Because especially if when you're watching the film, you notice all of the Benny Hill antics are the stuff that you see straight from the TV show. They put Benny Hill in this movie.
Yeah.
He wasn't portraying a character. He was basically portraying the Benny Hill that you would get on TV.
You could probably take some of his scenes, get rid of all the dialogue, put Yakety Sax in the background, and it would fit just fine. Oh, woman can't get through the door. What's he do? Grabs her ass and pushes. So, yeah, that's exactly Benny Hill show.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons why there's such a problem in Hollywood right now. Heyo. Yep, I went there.
Yeah.
I went there. But what about you, Chris? Who in this cast were you familiar with? What were some of the draws?
I'm pretty much on the same boat. It kind of ended with Benny Hill for me.
I will say for me, the one that really stood out, it's one of those things like I still can't believe that he's in this movie. Noel Coward. Noel Coward is... like, how do I put it? This would be like watching, let's say, Morgan Freeman in a Marlon Wayans film.
Huh.
You know, it's like, you know, this is a guy that, you know, he worked with David fucking Lean, for crying out loud. This is the guy that gave us such, you know, movies like Brief Encounter. You know, it's like thinking that Alfred Hitchcock had a bit part in Smokey and the Bandit. That's kind of how I feel. It's like, yeah, how? Of course, when I find out why he came in on this movie, it kind of made sense. Peter Collinson, the director, is his godson. And on top of that, apparently Peter Collinson's background was pretty rough. It was a pretty rough childhood. And Noel Coward did this as a favor and as a sign of confidence in his godson. And I'm going to just say this right now. Thank you so much, Noel Coward, for slumming it in this movie. I think half of the things I absolutely adore about this movie come from Noel Coward. I'm sorry. I've been holding this in for a very long time since I saw this movie, but this movie is so fucking British, it could enroll in the NHS.
No.
It comes with its own tea and crumpets.
Yeah.
I was
going to say it was missing some tea, but yes.
No, it wasn't missing tea. You just weren't looking hard enough. No. This thing has got such a hard-on for the Union Jack. I swear that... That Maggie Thatcher probably, you know, I bet that when she was a teenager, she was thinking illicit thoughts, thinking about just the movie, not the people in the movie, not Mike O'Kane, just the movie.
Yeah,
this is wow. I have to admire. I have to stand up and salute a movie that loves its country so damn much. I mean, this is like watching those old, those 80s, like, you know, Stallone movies that were like America, fuck yeah, right? That the kind of like muscle bound G.I. Joe gung ho, you know, America, fuck yeah kind of thing, right? I mean, this is the same thing only for Britain, right?
That sounds how you really feel.
Well, seriously, I mean,
all you need is a TARDIS and you could be a little more British.
No, I even dare say that Doctor Who can be this more British. I mean, Harry Potter comes up as more Venezuelan in comparison to the Italian job. I'm just saying, this thing has got a hard on for the Old Kingdom. I mean, what do you disagree with me, Chris? Come on,
not at all.
How British this movie
is? It's very British. Yeah, I totally agree. Yeah.
And I'm just gonna put it this way. I fucking love that. I fucking love how British this movie is. I just, you know, every time it plays God Save the Queen or God Save the King, I don't know which would it be considered. They're under the Queen, but yeah, every time that it plays God Save the Queen, I just, part of me just smiles at just how unabashedly, unashamedly British this movie is. You know, and considering that it has Italian in the title, you know, I don't know what to make of that. I don't. I mean, the movie's so British, and yet it doesn't have the word Britain anywhere in the movie. It has another country's name in it. It's like, is that kind of meant to be a dig, or is it one of those things, well, you know, but...
if it had been successful and they would have gone for a sequel, the next one could have been the German job. And you know exactly what you're getting. British going after Germans, crap.
I'm also going to just put it this way. In a way, despite what I feel about the film as a film, I would have loved for the movie to have been so successful they'd gotten a sequel. Come on. Yeah. Could you not see a full franchise of this? I mean, this thing is just begging for kind of a James Bond franchise type of thing, right?
It's almost also like the anti Fast and Furious. We got big cars, big engines, and big muscle. No, we got small cars. They're highly maneuverable. And we're going to toss gold in them and run in through tight places. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Hold on. We cannot talk about the car chase just yet because
there's a lot before that.
All right. Here's the question I have about this movie. Is this movie a heist movie, or is it a comedy with a heist in it? Because I don't know exactly if you can really consider this a heist movie, considering that the heist itself is kind of an afterthought in some areas, right?
Yeah, I think it's comedy. It's comedy in that British dry sense comedy, which a lot of Americans don't get. So it becomes a heist movie when you look at it with comedic elements.
Oh, Kent, yeah. You are so dead on when you say that. One of the things that, as I was watching the film, that I kind of realized is that this movie, while it is kind of a posh 60s a British movie, it reminded me a lot of old 30s and 40s Ealing Studios comedy films. Have either of you seen The Lavender Street Mob?
I don't think so.
By any chance, with Alec Guinness?
No.
Okay, the Lavender Hill Mob, and there's other Ealing Studio comedies. But the thing is, I'll tell you right now, they are super dry. I mean, so dry, you know, you put it out in the sun and it'll catch fire. That's how dry those comedies are. But they're brilliant. I mean, hands down, brilliant comedies. But yeah, if you aren't prepared to do a little work and to kind of pay attention and, you know, kind of go with the movie and kind of accept it on its terms, yeah, you're going to probably fall asleep in it really easy. But yeah, as I was watching this movie, this movie's a little bit more posh, it's a little bit more hip, it's a little bit more wink at the audience than those Ealing Street comedies. But it still had that same sense of dryness, that same sense of, you know, we're playing it super serious, yet it's really kind of silly, right? That's kind of the feel that you get with this, right?
Yeah.
All Or do you get a different vibe off of it? Is it more kind of goofy? Kind of, I mean, with the exception of what we'll call the Benny Hill moments. The Benny Hill moments are definitely where it goes super wacky. But outside of that, it doesn't, right? Because when Benny Hill is coming out of the police car, they intentionally speed it up, and I think they did that specifically because that's what you expect with Benny Hill, right? I'll even go so far as to say is that the Benny Hill stuff kind of feels like in a different movie than the rest of the movie.
Yeah, I can see that.
But he doesn't interact as much either. It's like he's there for task, and it is so far.
I want to say that there's only what, like 3-4 scenes with him in it.
Yeah, I think
something
so.
Like that.
You know, his introduction.
The introduction, the big meeting where everybody's in the room together.
Yeah, the actual going in and changing the tapes.
Yeah.
And then
his arrest.
Then his arrest. And those are really the big things. I mean, he's not even in the bus at the end of the film. You know, because he's been arrested. And I was expecting with him being arrested that was going to have some impact on the heist itself. Like, it was going to throw a wrench. And nope. Basically,
his job's done.
I'll even go so far as to say is I think even the Benny Hill stuff was done, like, after the fact. Like, oh, we need more comedy. So let's get Benny Hill. We'll throw a few scenes in, and we'll have a reason for him to be in.
No, he was, according to the commentary, he was in pretty much from the beginning.
It doesn't feel like it. Yeah. It feels like it's tacked on just a little bit. Because, I mean, outside of the fact that, you know, that he does, you know, that you know, he puts the computer tape in. The thing is, you know, they make it such a big deal. Oh, well, you need to have a technician that does this. They're just installing a cartridge.
Yeah.
It's not as though he's writing code.
Yeah. I expected him to write code or check the code or modify it so it's exactly what they need at the moment, but... Yeah, there was talk of him, you know, the one tea assistant we see right before we meet him. There's talk of him playing her in drag. If they current cast part.
Actually, I think he did. Or...
No, he no. They were thinking about it, but no, that's an actress, so.
Well, she kind of looks like him, though. That's the thing.
Yeah.
But, yeah, that's interesting. But I will say this. Okay, so, all right. What I have to admire about this movie, outside of its Britishness, is the fact that it has such a ludicrous kind of setup, and it embraces that ludicrousness of the whole situation. Basically, all the criminals kind of are respectful of this organization that is run out of a prison by Mr. Bridger, who basically runs all of crime in the UK, right?
Yeah.
I mean, there's something that's so fucking British about a guy that does that won't take down the Bank of England because he's afraid of the global impact of the pound. It's like he's so responsible.
It's if you hurt the British economy, that hurts your future plans of criminal activities in Britain.
And yet he sanctions a hit on the Italian infrastructure.
Yes.
Simply because of a trade happening between Italy and China.
Yeah.
Again, that just feels so British. Doesn't that just feel British? It's like the most British thing that you could possibly do outside of, like, not go to the dentist?
Apologies to our British fans.
We're talking about the 60s here. We're talking about the 60s. And you can definitely tell that the people in this movie have not seen a good dentist in a long time. Just saying. Just look at the teeth. Just look at the teeth. They just say all the things you got to say. Anyway, but after insulting...
The entirety of 60s UK.
that's okay. They have their own deals to deal with Brexit. Anyway, I don't know. It's just, you know, it also kind of reminded me of John Wick a little bit, kind of how they set that infrastructure up about, you know, this kind of hidden society, these unwritten rules that you kind of have to play by, and how Mr. Bridger kind of runs things. He kind of has to sanction these really bigger jobs, and that it kind of goes through a kind of a business transaction, right? I mean, you know, they'll kind of front the money. They'll kind of organize the talent, And it kind of comes to Mission Impossible a bit, right?
Yeah. I'm just thrown off by the whole, gotta break into the bathroom.
I was thinking about that too. That's funny.
I love that. I love how they set up Mr. Bridger. How, you know, when we first see Charlie Croker, Michael Caine's character, leaving prison, you know, they set up Mr. Bridger. They set up kind of the situation. We get kind of a look at the underworld that we have here. And again, I just kept going back to John Wick, you know, just kind of this hidden society, you know, that they really don't have to worry about the cops. They don't really have to worry about the law. In fact, I don't, with the exception of like the major chase, we don't really see law enforcement being a huge threat, right? It's, in fact, they make a bigger deal out of the mob, which, you know, in the first scene during the title, through the credit sequence, we find out, you know, that the mafia, the Italian mafia, is really the force that you have to be concerned about. You know, they make such a big deal. And I will say that one of the things that really kind of really pissed me off about this movie is you set up such a huge force. You set up a confrontation with the Italian mob. You know, they don't just, we see it twice that they threat, you know, that they make big threats, right? So you're expecting there to be a more formidable force to be had against this mafia. Yet when we get through the chase, they don't really have anything to do with it. They kind of are even more ineffective than the police, right?
They'd rather let the police deal with it. That way their hands are clean. But then they didn't expect these guys to get away.
From a story structure, though, they set up like with that opening shot, you know, with the gangster and the red hot Ferrari, you know, going through the tunnels, and then he gets killed by apparently not putting on his, you know, forward lights in tunnels. Which, seriously, I mean, yeah, we do see that he's going really fast, so that does.
I think that was the problem.
To
he
it.
Was going just he was speeding. So.
Well, I don't know if they had speed limits on those roads.
Yeah, I don't think they
do. And they're so fucking narrow. I have to admit, though, it's a really exciting sequence. And it definitely sets up the vibe that we'll be getting with the chase at the end of the film. It does set that up. But, again, I think it was meant to play as a joke, right? You know, he goes to a tunnel. You don't even see the crash. You just hear it. And then you see, you know, a bulldozer pulling out with the... with the car kind of caught in its, you know, in its shovel, right? And then we see it get thrown away. And again, that sets up the threat. It sets up that the mafia is the genuine threat to what's happening here. And then again, we see them again. We you know, they threaten Charlie, in, you know, outright. You know, they destroy his car. Again, setting up that this is a force to be reckoned with. So when we do get to the finale, to the big chase, we're expecting, they get away from the cops, but they still have the mafia to deal with, right? That's kind of how they're setting that up.
All those guys with guns, some of them should have shown up somewhere along the path just to take shots.
Well, I mean, yeah, just anything. Just show that the mafia is actually having to deal with. And that's partially why I think that there was kind of an idea for a sequel in the, you know, at least kind of rummaging around. Because if that were the case, in the sequel, that's who they're really having to fight against, right? We would have Charlie and his gang going up against the mafia. I mean, that especially if you keep it in Italy. Because they also have a really great line that's done by Mr. Bridger. It's like, you're not, if, you know, you only come back to Italy if you're in your own casket, you know, which is a really awesome line. He sets up, you know, you don't mess with the mafia. Once you're done here, once you have taken this $4 million in gold, you are, you know, you are banished from Italy. You cannot come back, you know. And they set that up so well so that when you do have that confrontation, it's not there. But what do you take from this? I mean, did y'all see the mafia being a bigger threat? Did you feel that that was a missed opportunity? Or do you think that there was something more to that?
I think it's a misdirection. So when we finally do get to the ending, it's like, wait, what? Which we'll get to at the end of the podcast. Well, but yeah.
I mean, yeah, well, it might be a misdirection, but if it's going to be a misdirection, you still have to address their presence. You have to show them doing something, you know, even if it's what you don't expect. Otherwise, it just feels like it's a gap.
Weren't they in traffic control, a couple of their agents?
No. No, they didn't have agents in traffic control, but they did keep an eye on things. I'm going to say when it comes to the traffic control elements, and I will say that even the actual heist itself, the Italian Job remake probably did a better job of using the pieces it has more effectively than this movie. But one thing that I don't know, the problem with the remake that I have is the fact that everything feels like it's designed specifically to get to that finale, right? It feels manufactured, where with this, you know, you feel a natural progression. We see them, you know, we see how they, you know, develop the cars to make sure that they can do the incredible stunts that we're about to see them to do. You know, we see the drivers. We see kind of everything come together. In a way, again, it reminds me of Ocean's 11, the remake of Ocean's 11, because in that movie, it was all about the setup, right? You know, you, even when you thought that there was a curveball that was being thrown at Danny Ocean and his people, we find out later that they were anticipating that curveball, right? That they really, that there was at no point where they weren't in control of the situation. And this movie kind of had that same vibe to it, right? Like, even when you would think that, okay, well, this is going to have a foil to their plan. Nope, they pretty much anticipated it. It had no impact on the job itself. In fact, the only thing that had an impact is the fact that their bus driver got a little cocky. Really cocky.
That bus driver sucks, man. Fuck that guy.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, do y'all kind of get that same vibe, or do y'all see something else from this?
Sorry, I was about ready to sing a song. I mean, they always survive. High self-preservation. Yeah. Almost like organizations.
You mean like a society?
Yes.
Okay. Nice society. Well, there you go. Well, another thing that I absolutely love with the funeral scene, right?
Yeah.
Where Mr. Bridger addresses Croker and the whole crew, and he makes it very clear that, you know, if you do not come back with this gold, you probably are going to be in these caskets.
Yeah. Because I'm pretty sure...
Again, there's something so British about it. It's like...
I'm pretty sure nobody was in those caskets to begin with. Hey, we need a fake funeral so I could be allowed out of the prison for her. Oh, okay.
You hope that there's no one in those caskets. For all I know, it's like, oh, sorry, old girl, but we have to kill you just so that we can have a funeral. It's like, yeah. Mm. That's, I don't know. That's also kind of very British, you know, that kind of pragmatism that, you know, that borders on complete disregard. But I don't know. It just, this movie is so lighthearted and goofy and fun. And do y'all feel like there are any stakes to this? Do you feel like that there's any pressure, that there's, you know, that at any point that there's going to be any kind of, you know, ramification to what's happening?
I'm still kind of amazed nobody got killed. So...
I admire that about this movie,
yeah,
to be honest.
It's very non-violent with all the theft.
I just, there's just something that just, I mean, for a harm, and I'm going to use the word harmless when talking about this movie, because it's harmless. There's nothing about this that has any maliciousness. Even its criminals are lighthearted, jovial types. They don't mean to cause any impact on anything besides certain infrastructures, right? The man, so to say, you know. And even so, they're still working for the man, because Mr. Bridger is definitely a man of the system, and he himself is interested in the prosperity of, you know, of the British economy, right? So it's not as though that they're like some sort of anarchists. Right?
They just want gold.
But, you know, but the same, but I don't know. It's just that it's really harmless. It's really kind of goofy and, you know, it plays by its own rules. I mean, is that a bad thing? Or did y'all see that as being a negative thing for this film? Or do you think it's something that the film should embrace?
Well, if you look at it as a comedy, you got to keep it light.
Yeah, but that's the reason why I asked if you thought it was a comedy or if it's a heist movie. Yeah.
Even as a heist, well, they do say that the nature of the heist is a smash and run, which implies injuries.
Oh no, but, no! It's a smash and grab. Yeah. Basically, you hit them, you take the gold, and
you run.
You know, and I love the fact that they kind of like Ocean's 11, they give you how they're going to do it. It's one of those things like a magician that's telling you kind of how he's going to do it without exactly showing you how he's going to do it, kind of thing. Like, you know, well, you're going to see this and you're going to see that and you're going to see that. And you're just thinking, how is that going to happen? How is that going to play out? And then, of course, we see it in action and it plays out just exactly as they say, with the exception of one thing. Again, this is another one of those things that kind of pissed me off. They set up the bridge, right? We have video things.
Yeah.
We have these video essays, which are basically reports to Mr. Bridger, masquerading as documentary or news footage. And they set up that, you know, they have to get across this bridge. If the cops control this bridge before they get across it, then the whole scheme is a bust, right? And yet, I don't even think we even get that bridge. Or if we do, it's like, you know, it's... What, just kind of a blink and you miss it kind of thing?
Yeah, I didn't even notice it, so...
I mean, wouldn't it have been great if, like, we saw that the cops had controlled that bridge and that was when they decided to use that little ramp thing that they used to, get across the river? That would have been kind of awesome if that were set up a little bit better and have a little bit more payoff for that particular sequence, right?
Which I didn't even get. When did they have need of that ramp?
Well, they needed the ramp because they were being chased by the cops and by the mob.
Yeah.
It's more the cops than the mob. It's like mob just grabbed like one car. It's like, oh, you know, this is important to us, but we just want one car. That's all we need. Yeah, the cops are getting their asses handed to them, and we're watching them bungle this whole thing. And we know who the people are. We know kind of the route that they're going to take, but we're not going to do anything about that. Like, what? It's like so many missed opportunities for tension and for, you know, for suspense. And thrown out the window. Just boom. Far out the window. With the baby in the bathwater and the Union Jack. Just seriously. I think that's the frustrating thing about this movie. It's like there's stuff in here I really enjoy that I'm just like, giddy and just having a blast watching, and yet that movie person inside me that knows kind of how if you set something up you should pay it off, that you create this tension, that you need to have something happen to actually deliver the goods for that tension.
Nope.
We're not gonna do that. Charlie Cook is gonna put his girlfriend on a plane. The mom knows she's on the plane. Do we ever see any of that payoff?
No.
Nope.
Now, apparently in an alternate ending that they wrote but never did, apparently there are like four or five alternate endings, they meet up again later on. She shows back up at the end, but yeah.
But doesn't it feel like it's a setup for a sequel?
Yeah.
Like, you know, like they were putting pieces together, like this is the Italian Job part one and that there's going to be a part two that they knew that they were going to get but didn't actually get? Because there's so many pieces that could be in play here. And this is a 100-minute movie. They had time. They could do the rest of this. It could have just add 15 more minutes to this movie, and you could pay off so much of this. Nope. Nada. Nyet. We're going to completely ignore that ever happened. It's like, that makes like almost about a fifth of the movie completely pointless. And that's a problem, right? Do y'all see a difference, a disagreement in this? I'm curious. I really want to know if those scenes pay off in any shape, way, or form.
Well, we needed more time to have a car chase in current break.
Okay. Let's talk about the car chase.
Now, because... I have to point out, though, interestingly, for all your complaints, apparently there was only one deleted scene in the whole movie, and it involves the car chase.
I think that's what pisses me off. It pisses me off, like, no, because that means that they weren't intending to pay this shit off. They knew that in the screenplay they had these scenes, and yet they're just going to leave that completely void in the ether. Like, major characters, not even in play. You know, we have, what, I want to say, what, maybe 13 people on this job, and only, like, six of them actually have are interesting enough to warrant, like, parts, lines in the movie. And most of them are, like, maybe, like, two lines. I think one character, I think the most that we know is the fact that he gets sick if he's in the back seat.
Yeah. And Big...
And does that even play into it?
Nope.
And nope. And Big Mike just doesn't like the color of the coach. So...
And the fact that he decides that the best time to catch up on his drifting skills is with a bus with $4 million of gold and about 20 people in his bus without seatbelts or seats. Because, you know, when you're taking Italian slope roads at about 90 miles an hour, you're not worried about people moving from one side of the bus to the other, basically knocking it off the road.
Yep. The gold should have been moved farther forward to begin with, tied down, and have everybody shut up and sit down.
Yeah.
Focus that center of gravity.
But let's talk about the car chase. Come on, let's talk about the car chase. Okay, Chris, you're really quiet. What did you think about the car chase?
Man, I don't know. It was okay, I guess. I wasn't
okay. I'm not gonna say it's the top one of the top 10 car chases of all time. But you got to admit, they really stepped up and really made a chase regarding three minis, and a bunch of small Italian cars actually interesting.
Do I though?
I'm just saying that is a difficult.
It made me want to buy a Mini Cooper. It's the greatest commercial for Mini ever.
I will say I had a whole lot of fun, and I think part of it is kind of the handheld way that they shot the film and shot the car chase sequences. Instead of using a lot of long shots they took some long shots, but you know, these kind of wide angles and, you know, long range shots, they kind of kept it personal. They kind of kept the camera close to the cars, making sure to move with the cars. Especially admired the way that they used the turning capabilities of the Coopers, and specifically when regarding like the pipes and the close quarter stuff, where they're in those really tight nooks and crannies, really getting you the feeling of the claustrophobia of those shots. And then of course we got Quincy Jones.
Yes.
Which Quincy Jones deserves a lot of credit for this movie. Right?
Do we want to sideline Quincy Jones here and just go?
Well, no, we'll talk about Quincy in just a moment, because okay. there's parts of his music that has nothing to do with the car chase. But the car chase itself, you have to give Quincy Jones some credit, because his score just fits beautifully with this car chase.
During the commentary, the producer and the historian behind it just kind of agree. The car chase is not edited together well, but the music offsets everything so you don't notice it. It just makes
I'm pretty
it
sure
feel.
That if you watch the car chase with no sound, it will...
It's
it,
not, yeah.
It takes away. I love the shots. I will say that the editing is terrible, because they do not set up the geography very well. And you know how I feel about geography. You have to set up geography, especially with car chases. You have to set up where it starts, where the middle is, and where it ends. And there's three places that this car chase takes place. First, you have the traffic jam.
Yeah.
You know, that's where they set up, they grab the gold, and then they go. At that point, then you have throughout Turin. So you have the non you know, in the streets, but not in the traffic
basically
jam.
The sidewalk.
And then you have the yeah, that stuff was great. Yeah. Come on, I mean, I again the close quarter stuff. I will say that there were a couple of times when I felt like they were using the same shot twice. But the way that they kept the momentum going, and the fact that, you know, again, you have all of, you know, them running on these sidewalks. What is the normal thing that you would see with this? I mean, we talked about this when we talked about the French Connection. You know, like, you have to run over everything and just, you know, destruction and mayhem. And, you know, people running and screaming and, you know, someone getting hit. Someone's, you know, on the verge of death. Right? That's kind of the way that you would get it. And I think French Connection was what? About 1970? So it's like 1 year after this film came out?
I thought it was like 72. Yeah, within 5 years of this. So.
Well, 73 was Exorcist, yeah. And French Connection was the movie that got Franken the job for that.
Okay.
So maybe 71. So it was in that area. But yeah, the thing is that, you know, there are really good shots, but the editing, the making, you know, kind of making the audience feel like they understand what's going on or where in the chase we are. Yeah, the movie doesn't do that very well. It does not set up that geography very well. But I'm assuming that you agree with that, Chris. Is that part of your problem with the car chase, or is this something else?
I felt like the movie was very... I'm cool with British stuff. I like British humor. That's fine. That's cool. But, I mean, I was pretty bored during most of the movie. And then the car chase rolls around. Car chase was okay. It's like the movie was building up to it. Wasn't that good of a payoff. So I'm just kind of... I don't know. I didn't hate the movie, but it's like... I had a hard time getting through it. And then the ending just kind of... Yeah.
Do you mind if I ask, Chris, what is your... When you think of British comedy, what is the thing that comes to mind?
I mean, I guess Monty Python or Benny Hill.
Well, Benny Hill pretty much uses the same tactic. And one of the problems that I have with Benny Hill's work is, again, the fact that it's one note. It's pretty much the same thing over and over mm-hmm. again. Which is the same problem that this movie also has in that essence. It's again, the same note. It's, you know, we have a heist, but we're going to make a lot of British jokes. You know, hell, even the, you know, like half the gang gets away from the crime scene by imitating British hooligans yep. in an Italian soccer match, which again doesn't get paid off! Seriously! We don't even see the match! We told that England wins. Which, of course,
there was a plan to try and film an actual match and splice it in so it was going on at the same time. But I guess it got dumped because they couldn't get rights or something.
And are you going to tell me that a van with the words England to the cop
yeah.
isn't going to get looted in the streets of Turin? I mean, I let me put it this way. You couldn't get a 49ers fan in Dallas
yeah.
with just a bumper sticker and it not get lit in a flame. And we're talking about soccer. Yeah. I call bullshit. I call serious bullshit. Again, wouldn't that have been paid off? Wouldn't that have been a great payoff and some great comedy if, like, the Italians who had lost the soccer match decided to, like, beat up on this van? I mean, that would have at least been comedy, right?
And drama at the same tension at the same time, because
yes,
they don't know they're thieves that are ruining their economy. They think they're the evil British
soccer
players.
Hooligans. Which, again, would have been great British comedy. I mean, you know, this would have been something that Monty Python would have, like, killed to do. Like, this was like a setup that was just begging for payoff. Begging for payoff. You couldn't have begged for more. But no. So many missed opportunities. So many. Like, I'm just saying, just as a film lover, watching this, and just like, I can't even count on, like, all my fingers and toes and other vital parts of my anatomy. All the opportunities that this movie could have had for more, and it just doesn't do it. Oh, God, yes. But, all right. So, what did y'all think about kind of the way that it ends, kind of in the sewers, and the fact that, you know, they go from the sewers, they get onto the freeway, and, you know, basically pull a Spy Hunter, right?
You figured they would have practiced that part more, but they were down to their last few cuts.
Well, actually, I think that was what they were trying to do with that whole, with the Mini Coopers and the, you know, when they're doing the jump, or what looked like a jump, was that they were
setting this up.
Trying to,
They're setting that up as plan.
That's what I'm thinking. Either that, or they were trying to set up the jumps, in which, I mean, it could be both, but yeah, it would have been better if there was like some sort of stuff, like a question, like, why are they doing that? Like, you know, to have that question come up and then to have that reveal, that would have been great, right? You know, like, oh, they're trying to learn how to do this. Of course, with us now, we would kind of see that because, you know, that's something that's been in several action movies. But for a 1969 movie, you know, that would have been pretty kind of cool if they would have been able to set that up a little bit, right?
Yeah.
Just saying. But, all right, so I will say, when it comes to them getting into that bus, those vans were in sewers, right?
I mean,
that wasn't dirt. That was on the sides of those Coopers.
Well, they were, for filming purposes, they used a sewer that was under construction.
I know, but what I'm saying, though, is that in the film's continuity, that shit on those. And they're in the enclosed bus, right? Three cars.
That just ran through shit. Yeah.
Smelling of shit in that
Cooper,
bus.
Coopers, yeah.
What? But you've got half a ton of gold, so you're happy. And you're going to push those cars out here in a second anyway.
The smell's going to stay, though, right?
Yes! It's going to stay. And let's just say, for the sake of argument, okay, cars back then weren't sealed, which means that no matter how the fact that the shit itself got on the car, the smell would have gotten in the car.
Yeah.
Which means that the people in the car smell like shit.
Maybe they're bad.
Deathly smelling like shit. And yet they're laughing and joking and goofing. Like one of them holding their nose or vomiting or anything of that nature.
I semi-theorized they did some sealing of the underbelly just because they know they were going to go through water. But
well, no, I mean, they did seal the underbelly because they went, you know, they were going through like rivers.
Yeah.
Now, we saw that, but that happened before the sewer. Right?
Now, if you did the river after the sewer, we can wash off some of the stench, but, you know.
Maybe. I mean, that's if you, like, open the doors and everything, which, no. But, I don't know. That's, like, such a small thing to talk about. You know, like a mini sin, a tiny sin compared to the big ones that this movie does. It's like, you feel like you're almost, like, nitpicking, you know, by that point, right? But you know what you can't nitpick? You can't nitpick the amazing music of Quincy Jones in this movie. Because
unless it stays in your head and you can't get rid of it and you're singing Self-Preservation Society all week long.
In comparison to other songs that get stuck in my head, I welcome the Self-Preservation Society.
Which technically is called Get a Broom and Move On. It's the official name.
It's the Self-Preservation Society. I'm sorry. That's what it is. You can call whatever you want, but that's what it is.
When you do a Google search for the lyrics, that's what cuts.
But you know, the thing is that it's really catchy. It's really fun. It's goofy. It's got, you know, it makes you smile. It is like the kind of for the vibe that this movie's going for is perfect.
And it's amazingly British, because there's actually a translation guide for it.
That's true. But the thing is that even the lyrics feel very British. I love it. I love this song. You know what I also love about this movie? I love the fact that this movie actually has been driving college students for the last 30 years insane. Did you know that there is actual challenges in college campuses on the ending of this movie called the Italian Job Challenge?
Oh.
They actually took Michael Caine's last lines in the movie as a challenge for engineering students. How can you? Okay, let's set up the ending, right? Because okay. I did in fact try my hardest to figure out how they're gonna be able to pull this off.
Can I just say it's a cliffhanger? It is a literal cliffhanger.
Boo.
That was intended. They did it on purpose. You know it. You fucking know that they did that on purpose.
It was still a dick move, no matter how you fucking look at it. Man. Come on.
They don't set it up. There's no foreshadowing
for this ending. Italian mafia being implied as the enemy. No, it's physics.
Which, in a way, is kind of a British joke. Let's be honest here.
The only thing that could stop the British is physics.
Yeah, but even then, they should have at least kind of set up that, you know, what I'll call the War of the Worlds thing. Like, oh, it's going to be the world's governments that kill off the aliens. No, it's germs. I mean, you know, they could have pulled something like that, as long as they would have kind of just at least reinforced, you know, that the mob and the cops and the Italian government all, you know, that they all failed, you know, just really hammer that home, you know, and then to set it up for, oh no, it's, you know, a dirt cliff and a jackass drifter, you know, drifting bus driver and poorly secured gold and a bunch of jackasses drinking, you know, in the back of a bus, you know, but I have to admit, though, whenever I hear Michael Caine say, "Hold on, lads, I got an idea," I don't know why. Maybe it's just because I love me some Michael Caine, but I believe that they made it through. I believe that they got that gold into Switzerland. What do y'all think? Do y'all think they made it? Do you think that at the end of the day, it's in a Zurich bank? Or do you think it's at the bottom of the Alps?
It would have been funny to lose the gold, but everybody survived. And then you have to do the Italian recovery job to go fight the mafia to get it.
Again, that's why I'm saying that I think it was intended to be a sequel. In a way, they were setting that up. Like, but the thing is that sequels were not very prominent in 1969. We didn't have many sequels. And even if there were sequels, they were usually kind of spiritual sequels, like the Man with No Name trilogy, you know, where they weren't really exactly sequels. They didn't like tie the same continuity, but basically just the same character on a whole different mission, right? So they were basically setting up what you would have seen as a direct sequel, right?
Yeah.
But I don't know, it's just the way that Croker kind of, you know, just that ingenuity and the fact that we've seen him basically pull off the impossible with the Italian job. Because let's be honest here, the way that they set it up is like, how on earth are you going to be able to do this in the middle of a busy metropolitan area with the resources that you have? How are you going to get away with this? And they do so, and they do so relatively plausible, you know, silly, more than likely going to fail, but you can believe it enough that you're willing to go with it instead of laughing it, you know, out the building, which is exactly what the remake does. Yeah. I will tell you right now, as much as I enjoy the remake, there's no way in God's green earth that would have ever happened. Ever. Ever. So, just saying.
Okay,
All right. But do you have any ideas as to how they got off that cliff?
Do they have any rope?
No.
Damn. Oh, they're fucking dead. I mean, the only thing dead. I could...
Now, they do have their clothes.
That's true. You could
and
do
in
that.
Fact, and in fact, the closest that they got, if I'm not correct, I think it's MIT. They got this. Apparently, there's multiple colleges that take this challenge. But MIT has a setup that they let out the air in the tires.
Front or back.
Which... Well, you can only get the front because the back are dangling off a cliff.
Okay.
But you remove the air from the tires. I'm assuming that they either poke it. I don't know if they have a gun. I don't think that we saw a gun in their
possession. You have a way to re-inflate the tires later, you could use the same device to deflate, but then you run into the problem later on. If you're deflating the tires, better have a way to re-inflate it.
Well, the thing is that as long as they can get the bus on the side of the road, they can probably drive or get some help with the tires, and it might just be that, you know, they just have all their blokes just air up the tires with their mouths, which have killed at least one of them. But again, I think the whole point was just to secure the gold. Just getting it off the cliff basically was the challenge. But they remove the air from the tires, and then everyone basically stripped down to their skivvies and hoisted the clothes to rope some of the gold.
Right, and that helps you shift the center of gravity back. So
Basically just little by little. Once you get some of the gold over to that side, then you can get the rest of it. But it's one of those slow things. But the thing is, they also set up a 3-hour window, as they thought that at least someone would have. Yeah. Well, either the cops come over those mountains or the mafia, or some random person finds them. And of course, if they do it, then they're going to call the cops. You know, if anything, just to save this bus, right? Yeah. But anyway. So that's how the movie ends, and then of course we get the panning shot where the camera zooms out and we look over the Alps and we get the Self-Preservation Society one more time over credits. Which part of me does kind of, as much as I knew that this was going to be the ending of the movie, anyway, I still kind of wanted to flip the bird to the movie because seriously, come on!
Fuck that shit.
There's no sequel. We're not going to know what happens. Hell, I don't even know if the screenwriter even knows how they're going to get out of that. That is so mean. That is the meanest thing that a screenwriter can do to his audience. But did y'all have that same feeling, or did y'all kind of like, okay, whatever?
I was kind of pissed that it ended that way, but...
It was a dick move, man. Total dick move.
All right. Is there anything else we want to talk about before we get into the geek sheet?
Don't think so.
All right. Kent, why don't you run us through the geek sheet?
Oh, I didn't get too much of a geek sheet going this time, but, you know, you just have Michael Caine, who's the greatest Alfred the world has ever seen, potentially. We'll argue that later. Master Wayne.
You mean the man who single-handedly fought off Jaws Jaws the Revenge?
Well, we're going to... No more Jaws sequels!
And also fought off Steven Seagal and the Muppets.
Well, yeah. I mean, he's had a very long career doing a lot of stuff, so...
2-time Academy Award winner?
Yes.
Just saying.
So... And I believe an SNL host a few times. But we've already talked about Benny Hill a little bit. So, but yeah, the great comedian. I just want to hear Yakety Sax have it come on every time he was on screen.
No, I get you. I understand what you
mean. And you wanted to talk about Noel Coward some more, perhaps.
Well, I mean, I mentioned basically all the big things about Noel Coward. So I'm pretty good there.
All the plays he's written, et cetera, and so on. And all the music by Quincy Jones. Well, not all of it, but he was musical director, did do a great deal of it, which I'm a bit surprised we haven't encountered Quincy Jones before. But he's... In the 80s, 90s, he becomes more known for TV work, executive TV producing. So, I mean, he basically took the friend... took Will Smith and changed him from the rapping Fresh Prince to the actor... who is now acting, so...
Ish, yeah.
Well, yeah. Hey, I'm excited about his new Netflix series, so...
Well, that makes...
You mean the Netflix movie? Yeah.
Is it a movie or is it a series?
It's a movie, not a series. It's a movie. Okay. It's a movie.
Okay. But yeah, I mean, there's just a lot he's done over the ages, and it just feels weird to see his name associated with this, but it's all... it's the music is perfection in this. Yeah. So, I mean, the music fixes plot holes. I mean, what can we say there? How often have we said
that? And I will say, when it comes to Quincy Jones, he also did a Steven Spielberg movie. He did The Color Purple.
Right.
Which, in my opinion, is a really great score, well, especially considering that, that you know, that, that Spielberg normally uses John Williams, yeah. And this time Jones does a really good job of conveying the feelings in that movie. All right, let's go ahead and let's call it right quick. We're running a little ahead of time. So, Kent, Chris, do you agree with the critics on The Italian Job? Do you give it a pass? Do you give it a fail? Or do you give it a maybe? Chris?
It's more of a maybe for me. It's not like a strong, almost passing maybe. It's like borderline between failing and maybe for me. It's like I did not have a good time watching this movie. If it wasn't like boring me to tears, I was noticing plot holes or wanting to throw gold bars through my fucking TV screen at the end of the fucking movie. Anyway, it was just kind of frustrating. So yeah, it's a maybe. I'll stick with a maybe.
Oh,
yeah.
Kent.
You know, I was very entertained by this film. I mean, I watched it the first time, didn't have a chance to watch it again until today, when I watched director's commentary and another watch through back to back, and it actually is growing on me every time I watch it. So I'm passing this, flaws and all. In fact, I'm ignoring the flaws, just saying they don't exist. It's
all right. I gotta use the restroom. I'll be right
back.
Suspense.
Okay.
Anticipation.
Is Michael Caine going to be in your restroom? He's going to tell him about the plans to steal something.
I hope he keeps this and like doesn't take it out and it's in the podcast forever now.
Yeah, that's how you end podcast. In fact, let's just stop recording.
Yeah.
We stopped recording. We decided that was the end. Yes.
Going to the bathroom is the same as being stuck on a cliff. Yes.
Yes. Well, if it's a bad bath.
Oh.
Could take a time to sing. So it's the episode of Podcasting Society. Didn't forget to mention that the it is the cast that sings this song too, so it's a complete cast recording.
Right.
So okay. So what did you see this week that you went to?
I miss a lot of stuff because of work and personal shit, yeah. But like, I did see The Disaster Artist, and that's really good.
Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah, and last week they had a showing, had a screening of The Room, but it was like audience participation, so they're like throwing fucking spoons and shit, and...
What, they're Rocky Horroring
it? Oh,
yeah.
By the way, I heard everything that you said.
Okay.
Thank you. Second off, me, Caesar, and Aaron, we're gonna go see The Disaster Artist, and we're hoping that like the Draft House is doing like a back-to-back Disaster Artist, The Room kind of double feature.
They're doing a one of The Room and the new one that Tommy Wiseau and Greg, was it Sestero or whatever? Best Friends or whatever, his new movie. They're doing a back-to-back screening of that with Greg Sestero in attendance. So. Yeah.
Cool. All right. We're gonna go ahead and get back to it. Hold
yes.
On. I'm just gonna do a 1, 2, 3 so I can. It helps me with the recording. Cool. 1, 2, 3. All right. So for me, I gotta just say, when it comes to The Italian Job, I can't help but like it. It's fun and it's harmless and it's goofy and it's silly and there's so many problems. And part of me does feel kind of like Chris with me, just like. Wanted to throw things at it, not for the ending itself, but for the missed opportunities that this movie has, and there's so many good ones, and like, but what it does, and it's fun, and it's goofy, and I love just the harmless and cheerful vibe that the movie has. It's a movie that I could put on and just kind of smile and enjoy in that level, and I don't know, it's just, there's not many movies that have that kind of good vibe, especially with Michael Caine. It is full-on most charismatic, you know, especially this period. I mean, he just oozes charm. I mean, if this was the first time I'd seen Michael Caine, I would have said, this guy's got a big career ahead of him. And, of course, he does have a big career ahead of him. He become Michael Caine. You know, he's... you know, he's just awesome. And this movie definitely highlights that. It's not his most greatest dramatic movie. I wouldn't even put in his top 30 or 50. But in charisma, in charm, in personality, he's got it in motherfucking spades. I mean, he oozes. I mean, when he puts on the suit at the beginning of the film, he looks fucking badass. I'm sorry. I just got into this character, and I could have followed this guy into like 10 more movies if they would have done sequels. But we don't have sequels. We have this. And for what we got, it's a lot of fun. I enjoyed it. Maybe a kind of a guilty pleasure a little bit. But the thing is I can defend the movie to an extent. A very small extent, but to an extent. But yeah, I'm passing it. I had a lot of fun. I honestly thought I was not going to like it because, again, you know, the whole kind of Ocean's 11 vibe. I was worried that it was going to kind of be kind of like that. But no, it's harmless and fun, and I can dig that. So, yes. But I think it's time that we go a little dark. Kent, where are we going next?
We are going into, you know, technically it's been called a superhero movie.
We're going into the Shyamalan-iverse.
Yes, which I didn't realize he's trying to create a superhero Shyamalan-iverse. So.
What, you mean that this movie is tied in with The Happening? Oh.
No, it's tied in with Split.
I know.
Yeah,
I know.
But yeah, we're going to see Bruce Willis, who I see not dying hard at all, and Samuel L. Jackson not being...
You mean Samuel Bad Motherfucker Jackson?
He's not really being a man bad motherfucker in this movie. So...
Oh, no, he's bad.
Oh, yeah, he's bad, but that's a spoiler. He's a...
I think it's not a spoiler.
Anyway, we're going to be talking about Unbreakable. Not Unbreakable, Kevin Smith. Unbreakable, the 2000 movie with Bruce Willis and Samuel Jackson. So, yeah.
And we're going to be pulling a couple of audibles for the rest of the year. There's been some controversies that I think probably need to be, you know, kind of taken care of before we talk about certain movies. So we'll be discussing the December episodes in just a little bit. I will say, though, that we're going to be carrying on our tradition in regards to certain space opera movies.
Only knew the saying. Power of the dark side of franchise.
Yeah. And, of course, we're going to have our big show-stopping final episode of 2017 that you do not want to miss this year, especially considering that it's going to be a really awesome one. I can't wait to talk about that movie, and we'll kind of give you more later on in the month. But, gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me for this episode. Do you have any final anything else that you want to say before we end the show?
Loved how Self-Preservation Society was the cast. Not professional. Singers. The cast. Sing. Sit here, have a few beers, sing a song.
Actually, that is perfect. Just perfect. Let's end the episode that way. Chris, you got anything?
Nope.
Alright, then let's do it in the episode this way. This is the Movie Dude Eric of the Self-Preservation Society.
This is Kent.
And this is Chris.
And Bean. Or should I say, and Chow.